Africa Live.
Welcome to Africa Live here on thehoororadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we've got a great program lined up for you today. We're going to begin, we're going to be talking a bit about some of the things that we often talk about, some of the economic crisis of imperialism. But we're going to begin, first of all, going to Nairobi, Kenya. We are on the line right now with Wahu Kara, who is known as Mama Kara affectionately, who is a longtime political activist in Kenya. And so I want to, first of all, welcome you, Mama Kara. Uhuru.
Yeah.
Uhuru. First of all, can you tell our listeners, you know, we met you at the conference of the African Socialist International there in Nairobi, where there was there's a pretty difficult political situation on the ground there. Can you tell our listeners about the conditions on the ground for African people there in Kenya?
Yeah, the experience of the Kenyan people is the experience of the African people for the many decades and many centuries that we have lived in suffering because of a patriarch market economy, from slavery to colonialism and neocolonialism. And what is very disturbing here in Kenya now, it is because majority of our Kenyan people are not conscious of these historical problems and have fallen into the already tailor-made problems of Africa at the concerns of the political leadership that was imposed on us at independence and not addressing the really fundamental issues. So we have a situation where our Kenyan people are not able to appreciate the fundamental primary problems of injustice and therefore are not able to engage effectively. But I would also say that it is a moment that we are undergoing a very radical revolutionary process, only that we do not have emerged new revolutionaries who can be able to take the battle from our old heroes and heroines who have been carrying on big resistance, and especially the resistance of Mau Mau, which is a renowned historical time period where Kenyans showed that they can resist colonialism.
You mentioned the Mau Mau, and for those of our listeners who may not who may be new listeners and may not know much of the history of the Mau Mau, could you talk about the Mau Mau? Tell our listeners about the Mau Mau.
The Mau Mau was the resistance of the Kenyan people in the 50s, where they undertook revolutionary military resistance to British colonialism and naturally engaged with guerrilla warfare, and indeed were able to bring to the British experience that Kenya was going to be liberated. But the unfortunate thing about Mau Mau, it is because the British quickly co-opted those that were loyal to them and those they had trained to be traitors to our own people and put them in government. And that is the problem we are experiencing now, where we have those who are royalists to the British took power at independence and have continued to perpetuate exploitation on behalf of the interests of the North at the expense of us, and has continued to divide us into tribes. And that's why the post-elections of 2007 showed such very uncalled for experience to Kenyans to kill one another on behalf of maintaining and sustaining the comprando ruling class that has continued to be parasitic to our own people.
When you talk about this comprador ruling class, this these neo-colonial forces, they're like right now you have this grand coalition that is in place. Could you tell our listeners about the grand coalition and what its implications are for Africans there?
The ruling class is equivalent to the history of the Africans in the diaspora, especially in the United States, during slavery when they had Uncle Tom and Uncle Sam. And the ruling elite, like I have said, took the culture against the patriotic Kenyans and have continued to be the gatekeepers who opened Kenya to the plunder of the interest of the imperialists just for little tokens. And that's why the history of Africa since independence, that is since 1960s, will tell you of leadership that is very unpatriotic, and leadership which is not African in the sense of the African spirit, because it serves the interest of the foreign investors at the expense of our own people. And that's why, in spite of Africa having all the resources, both human and natural, we have continued to be a very poor continent because of this division of labor, of us being the creators of wealth and sources of that wealth, and others being the recipients of that wealth through violent means of conquest, and at this particular time, through conspiracy of our leaders with the interest of those who have continued to plunder our nations. And that is the situation that you'll find here in Kenya, you'll find in Congo, you'll find almost everywhere. And when we have had leaders who want to stand with our own people, like our gallant son of late in Burkina Faso, Sankara, he was killed because he was going to show and to demonstrate the treacherous ways of our African leaders today.
We're speaking here on Africa Live with Mama Kar, who is a longtime political activist in Nairobi, Kenya. We want those of you out there who are listening to participate in the discussion that we're having here. You can call one of our various numbers or email us. Our U.S. number is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001. Our UK number is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype for free anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. We also have in the studio with us right now, we have Chairman Amalia Sitela, the chair of the African Socialist International, as well as Comrade Penny Hess, the chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee. Uhuru, comrades.
Uhuru.
Uhuru.
I want to also ask you, Mama Kara, you know, while we were there, there was a lot of things happening. There was a serious kind of repression on the ground, including some assassinations, political assassinations that were happening there. Could you say something about you know, just the difficulties facing organizers there on the ground?
Yes. The resistance of colonialism in Kenya is right from the onset of when the British arrived here. And repression to stop that resistance also has been ongoing. And currently what we see, it is the same institutional government machines that have been used to repress Kenyans since colonialism, which are still very intact: the police, the special branch, the conspiracy of using parliamentary democracy, the governance of presidency with all the executive powers. All these institutions of governance are anti-Kenyan, but Kenyans have also continued to resist, like you realized in the discussions during the conference. And repression of that resistance is ongoing and has continued, and it manifests itself differently. In the 30s, during Mau Mau, many were taken to detention, many were killed, many were maimed. And even after independence in 63, whoever resisted, they went to prison, they were named, they disappeared, and it has continued so until now, when the resistance is en masse, and that is why there is outside killing, because insecurity can no longer be justified. And this is because communities now are out discussing and dialoguing and realizing there are things that are not right. And whenever they stand up either for their rights or even to question the manner of government and whoever is at the forefront, get exterminated or get into prison, get into false accusation, tried in kangaroo court. And what I am trying to say, the experience of oppression and exploitation has been ongoing, and at this material time is so sophisticated and so deep-rooted and so intense that unless as Kenyans we undertake a very clear ideological and revolutionary position to liberate ourselves, we are going even to lose the space of freedom of speech and association, which was secured by blood and sweat, by the Mau Mau, and which we have continued to safeguard since independence. So we are at a very revolutionary moment, and it's my hope that one person who prescribes and truly believes and is committed for total liberation of our nation, that this is the moment that we should stand up to be counted, to denounce capitalism, to denounce imperialism, and to organize and mobilize for liberation and emancipation of our own determination. And that's why this moment cannot be wasted or abandoned, because also it's a moment when capitalism is already with its worst scenario, and that worst scenario can be a scenario that we can be able to stop agonizing, but begin to organize and mobilize not only in Kenya, but beyond the borders of Kenya. And this is because the Kenyan situation is not only to the Kenyans, it is to the whole world, the world that has been besieged by the effects of capitalism, and especially after the Second World War, where we have seen institutions of, after the Second World War, where the Bretton Woods put in instruments of continuation of plunder and extraction of resources for the benefit of the few through institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, and the trade negotiations that are ongoing. So it is a moment to make a wake-up call to global citizenry of goodwill to connect and make linkages and be able to dismantle this monstrous system that is cancerous and that is decadent and that is defiled and that kills for once and for all, so that we can come with new imaginations, new visions for a world that cares, for a world that respects life, for a world that belongs to all of us. And that's why the African people, wherever they are in the world, must wake up, because we have been the people who have been used to sustain this system since slavery up to today. And that's why the Kenyan situation cannot be seen in isolation. It is a moment of creating a system. You can call it eco-socialism, economic self-life, whatever you can call it, but it must be a system that must replace capitalism.
Uhuru, Sister Carter. This is Chairman O'Malley Ishitella. It's good to... It's good to hear from you again. Listen, we think what you have to say is so important, which is one of the reasons we're talking to you now. But also, we had attempted to get you to Washington, D.C. to participate in the African Liberation Day African Socialist International Conference that's happening here for North America, but were unable to convince the U.S. consulate to allow you to get a visa. Our understanding was they only were giving appointments at a certain time, and we called and were unable to convince them to allow you a visa at an earlier point. But the thing is that that you are absolutely correct in your assumptions about what is needed in terms of the struggle against capitalism and imperialism, and it is extraordinarily refreshing to hear Africans talking about that, because imperialism has succeeded in camouflaging itself in so many instances. It did it after the defeat of the Kenyan Land and Freedom Army in Kenya, and after the so-called Mau Mau, the murder of Dedan Kimathi, and then following that, raising up people like Kenyatta and others as the true leaders of our struggle. They've done that all over the world, and right now what we are faced with is the Kenyan solution here in North America, where an African has been allowed to become president, and that has confused a lot of people, not only Africans here, Africans around the world, and other peoples into assuming that something has changed in the United States, and not recognizing that imperialism is imperialism is imperialism. And so it's extraordinarily refreshing to participate in this discussion with you. We are also actively, even as this discussion is occurring, involved in constructing, consolidating the African Socialist International, so that none of us has to be in a situation of attempting to struggle by ourselves wherever it is we are located, because what happens too often is that our struggles are isolated, and there are too few people who know Africans and other places who know what's happening in Kenya, and not only in Kenya, but that is true throughout the African world. And we have to capture a capacity, an organizational capacity, to speak for ourselves as one African people, embracing revolutionary solutions, and offering up our own vision of a free future. So there is a conference. There are two conferences happening this month. A European conference to build the African Socialist International is happening in Manchester. There's another conference that's happening here in Washington, D.C. this month, a North American conference, that not only will have Africans from throughout North America, but also from Central America, coming together to consolidate the African Socialist International. I wanted to bring you up to date on that, and we're looking at Zimbabwe for July. That is tentative, that we'll be in Zimbabwe for Southern Africa Conference as well. But the point is that that we have to consolidate this revolutionary project as an all-African project that involves Africans in every front, everywhere we are located, because we are not going to be able to win freedom independent from each other. I felt the conference that we did in Nairobi last month was extraordinary and historical, and obviously there's still a lot of work to be done, and I had hoped that we would have been able to consolidate much of that when you would have come to the African Liberation Day mobilization here in Washington, D.C. In any event, we intend to move that project forward, and I just wanted to express our appreciation, and I know you were there, and it was at this point that we really came to understand that the whole African world need to have access to you, and what you have to offer to this process. I was wondering if you could say anything at all about how you experienced the conference in Nairobi.
Count on me. One. I am one of you and part of you because we belong to the determination that history has given us this opportunity to be able to have the privilege to understand and to appreciate the genesis of the crisis we find ourselves as a people. And luckily enough, the exit out of that crisis, because it is to stand up and be counted. It is to stand up and say, what exactly is wrong? The system is what is wrong. And to appreciate and to energize one another that we have a capacity and a spirit to be able to engage with the system and indeed destroy the system, because the system has been parasitic on our blood and on our natural resources and our imagination. And this is a time to make that departure. My happiness about the African Socialist International is that now we can claim our own framework, our own platform, a connection and interconnection and linkage of our own people. And we do not know, we do not need to have worked with each other for years. We do not need to come from same neighborhoods. We do not need to have gone to school together. We only need to appreciate that we have a common heritage, a heritage to resist, a heritage to reclaim humanity, a heritage to restore nature and purposes for why we are the cradle of humanity. And that responsibility, that challenge, cannot be done without our commitment to revolutionary thinking, revolutionary clarity on the ideology that guides our plans of action, and respect of one another, respect of our leaders who are pushing these processes wherever they have been at. And that was for me, those few moments I was with you here in Nairobi, like I said at the conference, were historical moments, were emotional moments, where a dream came true to have a connection with our own, still taking the gallant spirit of holding the African spirit of never surrendering and never giving up. I am a child of Mau Mau. I am a child of that woman in 1800 here in Kenya called Mekarim. I am a child of that woman in 1920 called Mtangiro. I am a child of those men and women during Mau Mau in the 50s who went to the forest, who remained in the villages, taking care of our own people, who were the transport system of the gallant revolutionary moment that we engaged with the British in the 50s. I am a child of those women who stand up today and say capitalism must be dismantled. And I am that mother, sister, and friend who must extend the baton that I have taken, because the system is a relay race. You must run your race. And the most important thing for us Africans is to complete this race, no matter how long it takes us. It is us to reclaim the people of the world. It is us with our revolutionary spirit to state which system is going to galvanize humanity for the 21st century. I have no doubt in my mind that we will make it. And I am not overwhelmed by this connection with you, Chairman, and this radio program, and to whoever is listening to me, that we can talk to one another using this technology which was not meant for us, that we have turned it to our own use. Like how the Mau Mau turned the killing done to be done of liberation. So for me, this is the moment. And what we do is what is going to judge us in the harsh way or with dignity and honor of what historical role we play. So I give my solidarity to both the conferences in Manchester and also in Washington. I breathe life to those conferences. I shall be there in a spirit, although not physically. We Africans believe more in our spirit more than in our physical, because they have destroyed our physical, but we have never destroyed our spirit. And capitalism, with the crisis we are in now, want to destroy our spirit. This is the moment that we must stand to demonstrate that they killed the physical. They have tried to damage the mental. We are not going to allow them to touch our spirit. And that is what I should have brought in Washington or Manchester. And that is the mission that I have committed myself to in. That is what I say right there. That's what I can say anywhere. And upon my dead body, I shall never give up. And I have a historical record which demonstrates that I am clear in what I believe in and want for humanity, because as part of that humanity, prosperity is in our hands and we must make it. I use my historical material time is to deliver the revolutionary spirit to create a radical revolutionary system that works for life, and we must dismantle the system that works for profit and put in place the system that works for life. And that is the ability and the capacity of none other than the Africans, wherever they are, be it here at Maryland or wherever the Africans are. God was not a fool to allow us to be all over in the world. And this is the moment we must connect, seek each other, look for one another with one determination to reclaim this resistance and take it to a logical conclusion. I salute you, Chairman. I salute everyone, and I salute the conference in Manchester and Washington, and my solidarity, because I believe Uhuru Africa Moja Kokote Tulipo.
Uhuru.
Uhuru. thank you so much, Mama Cara. Your contribution in this program on today is an incredible contribution that is greatly appreciated. I want to ask one more question before we close, and that is, you know, on today in the U.S., this day is celebrated as Mother's Day, to celebrate mothers, but you know, particularly for African people, I think there's a special kind of significance of African mothers, and I wonder, could you speak to the significance of African mother?
Thinking about the African mother can make one very emotional and one very sentimental. Because the African mother who carries the womb, who nurtures, who protects, who cares, who sacrifices, who is the last person to be beaten because she never surrenders. This is the African mother that I see, I know, I am, and the African mother has manifested that capacity to refuse to die, but to live for Africa. That is the greatest wealth the African mother has given. The inspiration to her own children. The manifestation of nature that nurtures life. And the capacity to reproduce and produce and procreate and create in a very innovative manner. And that is the African mother who is never worried whether she has a shilling in her pocket, but she knows at the end of the day she will creatively be able to provide food to her children without a PKM budget, to provide health care without a medical insurance, and to be a peacemaker and keeper when whole nations are devastated by wars of plunder and extraction of resources. This is the African mother. The African mother who weeps for her own children but never shows the tear and the weakness. The African mother who continues to intervene with the spirit of Africa to reclaim Africa. And this father is a God that we can say, the African mother, the custodian of our communities, when people, men and people, they are taken across the ocean to other lands. And the African mother found a way of taking care of communities even out there. What can I say when I remember Harriet Tubman? What can I talk about her? I can go on and on and on and on to talk about this African mother. When I talk about Harriet Tubman, I also talk about Mekeselini here in Kenya. When I talk about my sister who refused to not sit in the bus, your great sister who started the civil rights movement by taking a seat and sitting on it. What can I say? I connect her with many mothers here in Kenya who have been able to deal with the structural adjustment programs of the 1980s, which have killed and collapsed the whole social system and infrastructure for our own people in the name of eradicating poverty. And I can go on and on to talk and to sing praises to this African mother, because, like I have said, the African mother has refused to die for Africa. She lives for Africa.
He's related to
Africa. You are listening to Africa Live here on thehooraradio.com, and we've been interviewing Mama Cara who's joined us on the line live from Nairobi, Kenya. I want to thank you so much, Mama Cara, for participating with us on the program on today. I don't know if there's anything.
I want to also thank you, Sister Cara, for joining with us to build this African Socialist International. We'll be talking more about some of the practical things that we have to do. And I know that with you in our ranks, it is just a matter of time before we succeed in liberating and uniting our Africa and our people worldwide. Thank you so much. Uhuru.
I thank you so much, Uhuru. And thank you. Uhuru.
Uhuru. So we're going to go to break here.
Africa Uhuru.
Africa Moja, one nation.
One Africa. One Africa.
Uhuru.
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 Uhuru. Uhuru.
Africa Moja.
Africa Uhuru.
So we're going to go to
Africa Moja.
Africa Uhuru.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, my sister. Uhuru.
Thank you, my brother.
Thank you. We're going to here on Africa Live on thehooraradio.com. But stay tuned, because we've got more coming up here on Africa Live. Uhuru. We'll be right back.
going down. African Liberation Day 2009. This year, on May 23rd and 24th, African Liberation Day will help to liberate Africa. With two conferences being held across the world at the same time.
In Washington, D.C. and Manchester, England.
Under the slogan, One Africa, One Nation, divided by colonial slavery, reunited by revolutionary resistance. Black people from throughout North America and Europe will be at these two events to build the African Socialist International.
And what's that?
A worldwide African revolutionary party to lead the black power struggle on the ground everywhere where black people are at.
That's right. One Africa, one nation.
The conferences will be held 2 days and will include presentations from leaders like Chairman Omali Eshetela,
Chairman of the African People's Social
Dr.
Party,
Aisha Fields,
Director of the All African People's Development and
President
Private
Chimerenga
Rights,
Waller,
President of the International People's Democratic
and at
Movement,
the Manchester, England Conference, Luwesi Kinshasa,
Secretary General of the African Socialist International.
While U.S. and European economies are falling all around us, now we must seize the time. Take the future in our own hands. Join the African Socialist International, the African Liberation Day 2009. The Washington, D.C. conference will be held at the Carlos Rosario Charter School at 1100 Harvard Street Northwest. And the Manchester, England conference will be held at the West Indian Center at 74 Carmore Road. Register today at www.alduhuru.org. That's www.alduhuru.org. And take the future into your own hands. One Africa, one nation. And if it's a question of who did this, the fact is police beatings make the streets testy like a litmus. And this is when the tide gets to turning. Guerrillas in the midst of South Side gets to burning. They learning, cause we've been organizing for a while. They yearning, the people going to ride to get what sides. Be concerned if you on the wrong side of the line, cause when you selling out they see you, cause nobody is blind. And so wild, white power dangles carrots to entice us. I'll be doing all that I can to deepen the crisis. Might get me, but it'll never be done till we want. The more Africans are killed, the more come. You can hear it in the distance, African resistance, raise your fist, it's time to get this. Yo, I can hear it in the distance, African resistance, raise your fist, it's time to get this. I hear them drums in the distance, African resistance, raise your fist, it's time to get this. I hear them calling in the distance, African resistance, now raise your fist and let's go get this.
They created a beast when it took us overseas. We was better to survive anything like killer bees. We've been through slavery plus the middle past. passage. Separated from our roots like some ghetto bastards. But more struggle make for better masses. We in a class of our own. Worker bees destined for the throne. We fought battles unknown. Every family got a story untold. That's how we came forth. So what we came for? Not to change laws, not some lame cause, but to beg for our freedom. The only thing my people ever needed. Black power was militarily defeated, but we rising from the ashes of defeat like a phoenix. So we here like a shadow, even when you can't see us. Who wanna see us? You wanna be us? You can't deceive us. This time we came with heaters. Black.
You can hear it in the distance, African resistance, raise your fist, it's time to get this. Yo, I can hear it in the distance, African resistance, raise your fist, it's time to get this. I hear them drums in the distance, African resistance, raise your fist, it's time to get this. I hear them calling in the distance, African resistance, now raise your fist and let's go get this.
Welcome back to Africa Live here on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and I'm in the studio with Chairman Omali Eshetela, the chair of the African Socialist International, and Chairwoman Penny Hess, chair of the African People's Solidarity Committee. Uhuru, comrades.
Uhuru.
Uhuru, Africa.
We up to now we've done an interview with Wahoo Kara, known as Mama Kara, who joined us live from Nairobi, Kenya. Now we want to talk a bit about the crisis of the economic crisis of imperialism. There's all this talk now about this bounce back that's happening, is this end of the crisis. Penny, I know you've been following the economic crisis closely. Can you give us an update on it?
Uhuru Nyabinga and Uhuru Chairman, it's great to be here always on the show, and it's an honor to be here, and it was an excellent interview that we just had, so it's a very good show today. I just wanted to talk a little bit about what you're raising, Nyabinga, because it's really clear overall that the crisis of imperialism is deepening, the economic crisis is deepening, but I think in particular the Obama administration is doing some interesting things to try to prop it back up and put Band-Aids all over it. But even as some people are talking about this, this recovery, it's very, very polarized, because even some in the mainstream media are talking about the depth of the crisis that exists and how... You know, it really is no recovery so far. And it's interesting how, particularly under the Obama administration, that they put out the statistics that are pretty grim, that are extremely grim for imperialism, and yet they might have a positive headline, you know, out there. And then when you really read it and study it, you can see that it's a very deep situation. Like one example is that this past week, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that there were only 531,000 jobs lost in April. And they were, a lot of the media and a lot of the government was ecstatic about that, because that was about 100,000 jobs less lost than in the previous 2 months. So, you know, it's like, okay, well, let's look at what this really means. So first of all, historically, a loss in a month of 300,000 jobs has been serious cause for alarm. So we're talking about way over that to begin with. But secondly, let's look at the real numbers. First of all, February and March numbers have been quietly revised, and they do that, and they don't make any fanfare about that, but they put the job numbers way up after the fact. So February's numbers have been revised upward by 30,000 to 681,000 jobs lost then. And March's totals were also revised upward by 30,000, making it, interestingly, 699,000, because they do not want that 700,000 number out there. Now, April's numbers, again, they're saying it's 531,000 jobs lost in the month of April. But first of all, the Bureau of Labor Statistics knocked off 65,000 workers for, quote, seasonal adjustment for no discernible reason. What is, you know, a lot of these pundits are like, seasonal adjustment in April? I mean, what does that mean? And secondly, the Census Bureau of the United States government just hired between 60 and 72,000 workers for a 10-week job taking the census. So this brings the real job loss numbers to about 663 new unemployed. I mean, if you, you know, because you can't count a 10-week government job at minimum wage as, you know, any kind of meaningful job increase for the government. And actually, some observers have estimated at least 680,000 jobs were lost in April, and one independent research company estimated that it was 745,000 jobs lost in April. So they're very clearly not reporting anywhere near the reality of what's happening, and even a 500,000 jobs, which is what they're saying was lost, is just a humongous amount. So we can say, what they're saying is that the unemployment rate rose from 8.5% in April to 8.9%, and that 5.7 million jobs have been lost since December of 2007. But many people, including independent research companies, estimate that there will be 10 million unemployed by the end of this year. So, which is, you know, makes sense. If it's even a minimum of 500,000 a month, it's going to be way up there. The real unemployment rate, which is the Bureau of Labor Statistics U6 method that it calculates the real unemployment, and that includes unemployment plus people who are not looking anymore and people who are underemployed, is officially 15.8%. And that breaks down in terms of nationality. Unemployment for white people, based on this U6, is 8%. For Mexican, quote, Spanish-speaking, is 11.3%. For Africans, it's 15%. And for African men, it's 17.2%. But it's much, much higher when you look at those numbers of, in terms of young African men in the inner cities, in the most impoverished areas, it's 50% and more. And we've seen that. I've seen it even said 80% in some inner cities, Chicago, Detroit, you know, all these kind of places where there's absolutely nothing. And then, of course, all the Africans who are in prison. And, you know, just to say, Chairman, I mean, I just was reading that it's before Congress to repeal the, what do they call it, the discriminatory sentencing for crack cocaine, which it's, what is it, 500 times greater for crack cocaine than powder cocaine, which breaks down to Africans versus North Americans. But what is that going to mean for all the millions of Africans whose lives have already been destroyed, they've already been in prison? Are they going to get reparations? Is it going to be retroactive? Are they going to leave all these people out? Another thing that I saw somewhere was an analysis of the thing that the Sentencing Project had put out, that the number of Africans in prison on drug charges has decreased by 20 or 30%, while the numbers of white people has increased by 40%. And then somebody did an analysis of that and said that actually what the government had done was taken out, quote, mixed race category, which had always been in African, and put it in white. And, you know, as the article makes the point, mixed race is African. And, you know, and so that added all these to the white population. And so they're doing everything they can to cover up the reality with these numbers, and it's deepening. But you talked about the so-called recovery. The stock market has been up for the past 8 weeks, and it closed Friday at 8,574, which is, that's the Dow Jones Industrial Average, up 30% from its lows in March of 6,440, but still way down from its 52-week high of 13,170 last May. And just in my observation, I would say that the Obama administration started around the end of February making, and Obama himself really, making open pleas to people to continue investing in stocks, and in particularly in equities, which means financial stocks. And we're calling on, you know, this sort of power of positive thinking. If we just keep having a positive attitude and not reporting such dire reality in the mainstream media, then the economy will have a chance to get better. And I just think it's interesting because that's when it started going up. But even like you were mentioning, Chairman, you can see some mainstream media that's giddy with these numbers, but then you can also see articles in Market Watch or Wall Street Journal or even New York Times that call it just a bear market rally. The bear market is a going down market. The bull market is when it's going up. And they call it a bear market rally. They call it a sucker rally. They call it the dead cat bounce. It has nothing really in it. It's just people. And it's low volume of trade. It's not millions of people, you know. So it's a pretty, everybody's expecting that it's, you know, it's going to come down, although it may take till the end of the year to do that. But during the great, what they called the Great Depression in the 1930s, the stock market, even in the time of the most dire poverty and unemployment in the U.S., the stock market went up 50% in 1930 and then collapsed 80% subsequent to that. So, you know, that's really what's being predicted to happen. And there's many, many places where people are like, don't, you know, just get out of the market right now, or just do day trading, trade for one day and sell. So that's what they, you know, they're doing. They're just trying to make some money, deal with their dollars and all that kind of thing. But the, again, the real reality of this imperialism, this capitalist economy built on slavery, built on genocide, built on the theft of the resources of Africans and oppressed people around the world, is in its deepest crisis that it's ever been in. It's interesting because this morning in the New York Times was an article about the wealthy of Detroit, not about the, you know, 900,000 Africans in the deepest poverty that you could ever imagine, you know, in Detroit, which I think we talked about a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. but about the rich white people who have been tied to the automobile industry in places like Grosse Pointe and Bloomingdale Hills or whatever they are, you know, these wealthy mansion-ridden, where it says the average cost of a house is $1 million and all this kind of thing. And the article was saying how these are all the wealthy automakers and the CEOs and all the spin-offs that go with that are now facing an economic crisis and certainly economic uncertainty. It said that they weathered many storms before, including the rebellions of 1967 in Detroit. They weathered all these other kind of financial bumps in the road, but now they may have to close the yacht club, close the, you know, all these people, all these mansions are for sale, and they're, you know, they're in this crisis. And it's just interesting. Because, of course, the African community is in the depths of crisis, which is never talked about, you know, in any kind of deep way. In terms of the states being bankrupt, California may need to borrow $20 billion next year. It's borrowing $13 billion this year. But the problem is that the states' credit rating has weakened, and it may not even be able to borrow that money. California is the eighth largest economy in the world. It may face another multi-billion dollar state budget shortfall despite sealing a landmark deal this year to plug up a $42 billion budget gap that caused the state already to halt thousands of infrastructure projects. And it's saying California is likely to have difficulty borrowing anywhere close the amount it needs because it doesn't have good credit now. It's lost its AAA credit rating on its own state municipal bonds. And that, you know, they're refusing. They don't want to take federal government money because they don't want to be beholden to that, which, you know, they have all their kind of interests in that, et cetera. So California's in a serious crisis. It has higher than U.S. average unemployment, like 11.5% unemployment overall as a state. And, you know, it's in a real, real serious situation. So, again, just summing up the Obama administration, it's talking up the economy. It's really, Obama has called on the power of positive thinking and getting through this crisis. Just pretend it's okay. Keep on spending. Keep on buying the stocks. Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve's Band-Aid, his method so far that he's used is called quantitative easing, which is just a fancy term for printing money. And that's what he's doing. He's just flooding the economy with money. He's given caused the U.S. government or led the U.S. government to give the Wall Street up to $13.5 trillion while they're doing their economic stimulus for the economy as a whole at $780 billion. For the whole of the United States, you know. So it's not something that's going to work. He's had this thing, the bank stress tests, which is complete lie. Obama was saying, oh, the banks aren't that bad, and Bernanke's, you know, been saying this too. But according to one author, there's five U.S. banks that hold 96% of all of the toxic assets, which is the bad debts. And the top three are, in declining order of importance, J.P. Morgan Chase, which holds a staggering $88 trillion in derivatives, which is more than the gross domestic product of the entire world, like 20% more. Bank of America has $38 trillion. Citibank has $32 trillion. Goldman Sachs has a mere $30 trillion in derivatives in the toxic assets. And the Wells Fargo / Wachovia Bank, which recently merged, has $5 trillion. So these are real things. It's not going to go away. It keeps compounding. And, you know, and what's happening right now is that we're going into a new era of foreclosures and mortgage defaults. Now it's going to be white people unemployed. Mm. So it's not only the Alt-A, which is the sort of subprime that they gave to white people, the changeable interest rate that would go up after a while was called Alt-A for white, adjustable, which was called Alt-A for white people. But what they call prime mortgages, the fixed rate mortgages, the people with the highest so-called credit rating, are for, you know, going into default in record numbers, and the banks are, you know, going to be affecting them and adding and compounding to all of the bad debts that they already have, because these Wall Street banks are some of the major, you know, lenders, and certainly Fannie Mae is in incredibly bad shape, and the CEO of that committed suicide a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. We have commercial real estate just going bad all over the place, whether it's malls or in high-rise buildings in downtown areas of every city in this country, including New York City. We have credit card defaults to the point that credit card companies are, even people who have paid month after month for the last 15 years on their credit cards are getting much higher interest rates being applied to them. Yeah. People who have maybe a line of credit in their bank account for small businesses, the banks and the credit card lenders are just going into those people's accounts and taking it back out, and the people didn't even know it till they checked it. And you know, we have the Obama administration bombing, just killed 100 civilians in Afghanistan, which the U.S. is denying most of that, but the U.K. Guardian and other papers around the country are attesting to that. It just went in and bombed 100 U.S. Civilians, women and children mostly, in Afghanistan. Continued bombing in Pakistan and what they call the SWAT area, and that government is in crisis, which has been a neo-colonial or at least a puppet government under the U.S. And then this whole crisis now that Iraq is not as stable as they thought, quote unquote, and that, you know, how many, which is a way of saying that they're going to keep more U.S. soldiers, U.S. military there. And just this past week.
Which is also a way of saying that Iraq is not as stable as they thought.
right, okay. And just this past week, the U.S. House of Representatives Appropriations Committee just approved Obama's war funding bill of $94 billion. And that includes, that's basically a counterinsurgency military budget that is saying that it's $94 billion. The measure exceeds President Obama's initial request by more than $9 billion. And $81.6 billion is for the U.S. military and intelligence operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. That $4 billion goes to expand and improve capabilities of Afghanistan security forces, with over $1.5 billion for development, agriculture, and rule of law programs, which is counterinsurgency. The measure provides $400 million for a new Pakistan Counterinsurgency Capability Fund to bolster efforts against the Taliban and extremist groups. You know, it just goes on, and it's also going to refuse any money to the Palestinians if Hamas is involved in any way in that. And, you know, it just goes on. But this just passed, and again, $94 billion. This is Obama, who is going to end the war in the Middle East. And you know, we can see the crisis is deepening every day, regardless of what you see in the paper or what you see on CNN or MSNBC. The crisis of parasitic capitalism is deeper every single day.
And when we were at break, Chairman, something you were noting was the fact that, you know, they're beginning to recognize that it's not just in the finance area, but it's more widely.
Well, some of the thinking representatives of imperialism is being able to say that, and they're even having discussions about things, talking about unregulated capitalism, mm-hmm. or reining in capitalism to not allow it to act like capitalism. When you look at what the Obama regime in particular is about, there was a time when before the economic crisis raised its head to the surface to the extent that people can see it so obviously, what we saw was political manifestation of economic crisis in the form of the wars, and people would blame it on Bush and saying Bush was this because he was doing all these terrible things in Afghanistan, and he was doing all these terrible things in Iraq, and he was initiating the bombing in Pakistan and what have you. Now you have a good guy, a Democrat, in place, and who's doing essentially the same things. And he's doing the same things because you cannot separate, in reality, the economic situation from the political situation. In fact, what they were doing politically was a manifestation of the growing economic crises. And some of that ought to be a bit obvious when you look at the fact that you have, I think they say, 70 to 80% of what they call GDP, gross domestic product in the United States or economic activity in the United States being consumer driven. Mm-hmm. So that means that people are buying stuff. They talked about it. It's a service economy. They've said this for years and years. Mm-hmm. What the hell does this mean? It's a service economy. It's not producing anything. And in fact, where production is happening now, they're moving increasingly. They're moving production into areas of the world. They say where cheap labor is, but not only is cheap labor there, generally speaking, they're moving production closer to areas of primary sources, you know, like the stuff that they are using to produce. And so you have a situation where the imperialist economy is while they're talking about the banks and, you know, rescuing the banks, but that still doesn't produce anything. That still doesn't create any production here. You're talking about just movement of capital, movement of money, movement of resources and what have you. And the production, the real production, the real resources, the real value is being created someplace else. And so ultimately the crisis of imperialism that we've been looking at under Bush is now revealing itself more sharply in the economic arena, that you can see this is, but we've said long ago, and it has already been noted by people before us, that politics is simply concentrated economics. And I think it's really important, like, to understand that. You look at this regime, headed up by, at least nominally, by Barack Obama. You look at the, you know, these people who are around him. These are the people who invented, who created the crisis, the person who was his primary financial campaign chairperson, invented the economic crisis, if you will, invented, well, at least its particular, its immediate manifestation with the subprime mortgage and that kind of thing. So there are a couple of things that I think is really important when we look at the crisis of imperialism, and you know, there's good reason for terror and concern on the part of the imperialists. And Obama, as has been noted, you know, is talking up, you know, like the economy. But part of what that they're doing is manipulating public opinion and attempting to even, it's a whistling in the dark kind of thing, where even some of the capitalists themselves, who are tied to the financial sector, who are tied to the stock market, they trick themselves into believing with these manipulated figures that somehow they can put some more money into the stock, you know, market, that seems to prop up something. But what is it propping up? The reality is, what does more infusion of capital in the stock market produce except higher numbers for the stock market? It doesn't mean that there's any greater you know, capacity as economic development or production capacity. It just means the numbers went up. And so it's like whistling in the dark. It's convincing people to continue to participate in this thing that is barely afloat, that is having, and they're papering over these huge crevices in a political economy that has no vitality, and it cannot have vitality to the extent that people are successful in wresting away from it their own resources that represent themselves in raw materials, energy, and stuff like that, but also in sovereignty. You know, people taking back their sovereignty, taking back political control of their own countries and circumstances, making it increasingly difficult for the imperialists to function. This is why you see this now development of this thing called the Group of 20. First, it was the Group of Seven. Then Russia had to be let in, and it became the Group of Seven plus One. Now, the success of these economies, despite the activities of this narrow club of imperialism, which has been extremely white and put itself forward, you know, based on a white nationalist, you know, racial kind of politic and ideology. Now, you know, it's got to bring in Brazil and India and China and South Africa and bring these forces in and try to rope them into a situation where they rest on this pedestal of the oppression of the rest of us and assume some of the responsibility for keeping the rest of us oppressed and some of the rewards that's assumed to be there for joining the club. But of course, the thing is that if you have this whole system resting on a pedestal of the oppression of the vast majority of the peoples of the world, and then you start bringing groups up from who constitute a part of the pedestal from China, from Brazil, from India, etc., and as a means of trying to keep the thing afloat, it seems to me that it ought to be simple that even as you're doing that, you're deconstructing the pedestal upon which everything rests anyway. Mm. And really you create the country. It's like trying to get out of a hole by digging it deeper. You know, it's like because the contradictions that we talk about are also a contradiction that gets transferred into the what now becomes the entire body politic in China, in India, and all these other places. You will also see the deepening of these crises of these contradictions that the imperialists have to contend with. So it's an incredibly significant period. And let me just say that ours is a small party, but we are involved in incredible work right now, and that is critical for this period in which we live and exist and struggle. This African Socialist International is the most critical development in the history of the working peoples of the world in the last, I don't know how long, since the advent of slavery itself and the aggression against Africa that has resulted in its dismemberment and dispersal of African people around the world. I mean, it is an incredible situation because we've gone through situation that we've been told should lead to the liberation of Africa, but it's been impossible to do it. We've had different sectors of our communities, the African middle class that's been created in the image and with the interest of imperialism, sometimes radicals that call themselves socialists and what have you. Whose capacity, whose vision have been limited by their acceptance of the borders that's been and the reality that's been imposed by imperialism. You're talking about an African Socialist International that has as a part of its agenda the whole destruction of the borders. This is not even permissible. It criticizes the existence of the borders that separate us in Africa, and it criticizes the existence of borders anywhere on earth that separate African working and oppressed people from each other, regardless of how they've been there through immigration laws or what have you. Those of us have been enslaved in all these different places. And the person you interviewed just a moment ago, Wahoo Kyra, repeats the thing that we've understood for a long time ago, that the destruction of imperialism, capitalism, is in the hands of the African working class. It is, we are strategically located all around the world. When the whole notion of workers of the world unite resonates, you know, most significantly with African people everywhere, and we are everywhere on earth, and this organization of the interests and of African workers spread around the globe is going to be the primary impetus, for the destruction of imperialism, and I think that's what the ASI represents. I think it's some significance. Here we are, this small party that we're talking about, just did this incredible West Africa Conference. This is one party, one organization, recognized with one center. West African Party in Sierra Leone with Africans from throughout West Africa. Just did the East African Conference to build the African Socialist, pull us all together in Nairobi. Is doing two conferences at one time on the same days in Europe and North America to make this thing happen. Right now, tentatively scheduled to be in Southern Africa in July. Having Africans coming to the conference that we're doing here in Washington, D.C. from Central America and what have you. The thing is, this process is in motion now, and we shall accomplish what Garvey set out to do a long time ago, and we shall accomplish it from a whole
higher level of unity and organization that was even possible during that era. And I believe that right now the ability to make the future, shape the future, define the future of humanity is in the hands of the African working class, and I believe it's organized representation, representative, the African People's Socialist Party, the African Socialist International, is the key to all of that. So, I'm saying this, that on the one hand, you've got this dire prediction that can be made for imperialism, and it's represented, we can see economically, but the reality is that the political manifestation of this that has been seen as war, etc., is also situations such as Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and Bolivia, the situation there, and the situation that we see with the emergence of the African Socialist International and the unification of an organized process of African people around the world to seize back our Africa, our unity, our sovereignty, our identity, and our integrity, like as a people, Uhuru.
Uhuru. Yeah. Uhuru, you're listening to Africa Live on UhuruRadio.com. We're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back with more here on UhuruRadio.com.
down. African Liberation Day 2009. This year, on May 23rd and 24th, African Liberation Day will help to liberate Africa. With two conferences being held across the world at the same time.
In Washington, D.C. and Manchester, England.
Under the slogan, One Africa, One Nation. Divided by colonial slavery, reunited by revolutionary resistance. Black people from throughout North America and Europe will be at these two events to build the African Socialist International.
And what's that?
A worldwide African revolutionary party to lead the black power struggle on the ground everywhere where black people are at.
That's right. One Africa, one nation.
The conferences will be held 2 days and will include presentations from leaders like Chairman Omali Eshetela,
Chairman of the African People's Social
Dr.
Party,
Dr. Aisha Fields,
Director of the All African People's Development and
President Chimurenga Waller,
President of the International People's Democratic
and at
Movement,
the Manchester, England Conference, Luwazi Kinshasa,
Secretary General of the African Socialist International.
While U.S. and European economies are falling all around us, now we must seize the time. Take the future in our own hands. Join the African Socialist International at African Liberation Day 2009. The Washington, D.C. conference will be held at the Carlos Rosario Charter School at 1100 Harvard Street Northwest. And the Manchester, England conference will be held at the West Indian Center at 74 Carmore Road. Register today at www.alduhuru.org. That's www.alduhuru.org. And take the future into your own hands. One Africa, one nation.
Uhuru, and welcome back to Africa Live here on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we are live in the studio with Chairman Omali Eshetela, the chair of the African Socialist International, and Chairwoman Penny Hess, chair of the African People's Solidarity Committee. Uhuru. We'd like to invite those of you who are listening to participate in the discussion that we're having here. You can do so by calling into one of our various numbers or emailing us. You can call the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. You can call our UK number, which is 020-8133-6629. That's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype for free anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and it's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Chairman, when we went to break, you were talking about basically the significance of the African Socialist International in this period of crisis and so much more, really. I want to ask about this period really seems to be shaking up a lot of the forces who are out there. And some forces who have called themselves African revolutionaries are really being exposed as these really opportunist forces. And while others who may be honest forces who been pushed out of who've for whatever reason been out of the revolutionary process, you know, for some time, or finding themselves coming back to the revolution. Why is that? Why is it that we're seeing this happening in this period?
Well, I think that it's easy to be for the revolution when the potential for revolution is far away. Everybody can jump on the revolutionary bandwagon. But the closer the potential for revolution gets, which means the deeper crisis in the society, the more necessary it becomes for forces to stand up for how they perceive their interests to really be. And you use the word opportunism, but I just want to make sure that people know what we mean by opportunism, because it gets bandied about a lot. But an opportunism is when you sacrifice the long-term interest of the revolution for apparent short-term interest of a particular group or a particular segment, you know, a particular class. And that's what we saw, for example, when
we were talking about this whole thing with Obama, or and you have everybody, you know, saying, well, you know, we got to support him because he'd get a black guy in there, and or you had people like Amiri Baraka, who is well known in our movement as the windshield wiper, because like all of the petty bourgeoisie, he's void of any ideological foundation of his own and borrows from whatever seems to be the strongest force at any given time. And so, you know, you have a force like Baraka, Amiri Baraka, who's saying that we got to criticize anybody that was moving in any direction other than supporting Barack Obama, because Obama, to not support Obama was to allow fascism to emerge in the United States. And you had a lot of different organizations who don't have a revolutionary agenda, who don't have a revolutionary strategy, who cannot criticize America, imperialism, America, the empire. They can criticize how it acts toward groups of black people. They can criticize it for locking up too many people in jail, or they can criticize it for acting a certain way, but they cannot criticize it as a social system incapable of being on the right side of history. It has no ability. It has nothing going for it at all. Born of slavery, born of genocide, it cannot do anything other than what it does. It is the nature of the beast itself. Mm-hmm. And so instead of making that criticism, I mean, and everybody seems to be on the same side, you know, when the crisis does not present possibilities for revolution, but when the crisis reaches a point where the possibility is a revolution, which means it's necessary for people to actually choose sides, choose real sides, then you see people separating out, and you see a lot of forces going to defend imperialism, and you see that they were simply white nationalists turned inside out. They're American patriots. An American patriot is a white nationalist, and I don't give a damn, you know, if they stand up for reparations or what have you. If you're an American patriot, you're a white nationalism, because America is something that was founded as a white nation at the expense of Africans and other peoples around the world. And it doesn't matter if Barack Obama is the president or if he's the doorman at the favorite club for the congresspersons, you know, who occupy Washington, D.C. So now, you know, our objective is to overturn the social system. Our objective is to destroy capitalism, destroy imperialism, to make revolution, to make Africa free. And to understanding that the only social force capable of doing this is the African working class, closely aligned with the poor peasantry of Africa, and also in unity with all the other oppressed peoples around the world who are struggling to destroy imperialism, destroy our relationship with imperialism. So that's how we move. You know, not looking for a new Negro holiday or anything like that, but to destroy the empire and the system of empire. So, you know, too often when we move, every time we move, particularly at critical points, we see within the general African communities supposedly involved in movement, we see counter activity because they are protecting their own black middle class, black petty bourgeois interests, even though sometimes and it's wrapped in these you know, radical clothing. It's the same thing. They are protecting imperialism. And this whole notion about even honest forces who are supporting, you know, who are opportunists, you know, it's been said before that honest opportunist is the worst kind, because the honest opportunist is motivated by conviction. The others, I mean, so there's no room for honest opportunism. In other words, because it is true, it's the worst kind. It is motivated by conviction. There are some we know are charlatans. We've known they were charlatans since they first raised their hair, since they were given significance not through who they were, but through attacks, assassinations, murder, slander, attacks on genuine revolutionaries or close to revolutionaries at the time. This is how they came to be significant. We know they were charlatans. And therefore, people who are relatively astute were able to identify them, but it's those honest ones, you know. Some people say, well, we even hear possibilities that Obama might be an honest opportunist, you know. That's going to make Afghan woman who's just lost her children through his bombing feel a lot damn better. That's going to make Africans who are due reparations in this country feel a lot better, because he's honest and he loves his wife and he's got a new dog and that he eats, you know, hamburgers at some local joint. The Pakistanis who are now being bombed are going to feel a lot better because he's honest and et cetera. I think that we have to criticize this whole system, and we also have to increasingly criticize opportunism in our own ranks, those people who try to hold up imperialism. There is no justification for supporting the American regime because of Barack Obama's there. You can't support. It's like what white people would tell us in the past, well, we don't support the war, we just support the killers who are going over killing people in the war. We just support the troops. You can't say, well, we don't support American imperialism, we just support Obama. Obama is the representative of the empire of imperialism. And if you're on the side of Obama, whether you call yourself a new Black Panther, whether you call yourself a minister so and so in the nation of this of Islam, whether you call yourself Amiri Baraka, the hip poet from yesterday, if you support or if you call yourself December 12th, if you support Obama, you support American imperialism. This that clear. You know, and we have to choose sides. Are we on the side of the oppressed peoples of the world? Are we on the side of the empire? And the empire is the empire, regardless of who it is that acts as a spokesperson at the time. And this is a convenient thing, you know, because we heard some people say, well, the people want Obama. The people, no, the imperialists want Obama, and then the imperialists put Obama before the people, and the imperialists pumped into the brains of the people that this is the solution. It's the responsibility of the revolutionaries. What is leadership? If you don't need leaders, if the people are going someplace and you just say, well, the people are there, what's the use of having leadership? That's just ridiculous, and it's an opportunist sellout position regardless of who's carrying that position at any given time.
Now, they're also in this period, there are forces who are finding themselves being drawn back into the revolutionary process.
Yeah, and that's the other side of it, you see, because there are people who have fallen, you know, gone and thought they could do other things, and as the crisis deepens, then they move back toward the revolution. Some of them had gone to some of these other organizations that we've just been talking about, and they see that these organizations are not moving on some kind of revolutionary trajectory. Some of them used to be in the revolutionary movement and haven't been for a while, and they are being drawn back to the revolution. That is the thing. At times of crisis, when revolutionary potential is greater, when the crisis of imperialist destruction is greater, you will see people lining up, taking sides based on what they perceive to be their real material interests. And you, as you mentioned, we are experiencing more people who are moving back toward the revolution. But guess what? They can't find the revolution if we don't show it to them. If we act like Obama is kind of sort of okay, if we help to disarm the people, you know, why aren't there greater mobilizations all over this country? Why is it only we are in Philadelphia chasing Nutter down the streets talking about, you know, what you're doing toward the budget? Why is it that we're the only ones who are fighting in Oakland, you know, around the Nixon case where he killed the four occupying troops? Why are we the only ones who are waging struggle in Florida around the murder? Not just waging struggle and talking about getting better cops, but, you know, exposing the whole social system itself. Why are we the ones who are organizing and using every resource we've got to build the African Socialist International every place in Africa? Because revolution is the only solution. That is the way forward. There is no other solution to this than revolution, and that's what we are about. And that's the call that has been made to everybody in the world, and they cannot locate us. How can a person who has the potential for making revolution find the revolution if those who are supposed to be about revolution got one foot in the Democratic Party and another foot someplace else. You know, they can't locate us. How do they make a distinction between the revolutionary, their own revolutionary interests and the interests of imperialism unless somebody has the courage to draw the line and say, this is revolution and that's opportunism and counter-revolution? Can't do it. That's why we have to, the struggle against opportunism at a time like this is a critical aspect of the struggle we're involved in.
Uhuru. You're listening to Africa Live here on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we're in studio with ASI Chairman Omalia Shetela and APSC Chairwoman Penny Hess. And we invite you to participate in the discussion that we're having here. You can do so by calling in or emailing. You can call the U.S. number, which is country code 001-727-565-1599. Or you can call the UK number, which is country code 44, and that's 020-8133-6629. Or you can call us through Skype for free anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. We've got just a few minutes left, really. I want to, you know, we talked a little earlier when we had Wahukara on the line with us. We had asked her about the question of African motherhood and the significance of the African mother. And I know here in St. Petersburg, later on this evening, there's going to be an event that's happening at the Uhura House at 1245 18th Avenue South in St. Petersburg, Florida. At 4 o'clock, raising up African mothers and Mother Africa, celebrating African mothers and Mother Africa. Chairman, I want to just ask you if there's anything you would say about the, you know, just the significance of African mothers.
Yeah, the thing is that this whole Mother's Day thing is a construct in this country of oppressor nation people. I think that one of the primary motivating forces to pushing for the development of what is now known as Mother's Day was, I think, a woman who was concerned about the mothers of the soldiers who died in the Civil War. You know, both sides of the Civil War. I think that was one of the outstanding events that gave rise to this whole struggle, and it's not the only one. There have been subsequent ones, but that seems to have been like the key, one of the key things. When they were talking about Mother's Day, they weren't talking about us, you know, African mm-hmm. people. And the reality is that all of the holidays that you would find in this country are holidays that serve to consolidate a certain American national identity. It is for whether, you know, everything from Valentine's Day to Christmas and Easter. I mean, even though some of them are things that experienced, you know, like throughout the world, they are used to consolidate an American national identity. But the African mother, as we had all these advocates of motherhood and all these people talking about the significance of Mother's Day, they were doing it, you know, while participating in brutality against African women and at slander, you know, the worst kinds of terrible things that imposed on African mothers and African women. And the reality is that, 170,000 years ago, Africa gave birth to all of humanity, and the 170,000 years ago, it has been found to be an African woman to whom all of humanity can trace ancestry. So it was Mother Africa that gave birth to the world. It was in what we would call an African woman, who is the mother of every living person on this earth. And it is the African woman who has bled profusely and cried profusely as a consequence of the terror that has been imposed on her offspring. And more recently and more specifically, we're talking about the offspring of those people who we would consider Africans today. It is the African woman who produced generations of children who were sold like beasts and worked like beasts, forced labor. It's the African woman who, mother who has had to see her children as convict, convicts and during convict leasing process, and even right now, who's had to, as a condition for surviving under imperialism, had to accept agreements that would not allow an African man, a husband, to be in the house to be helpful and to raise the children, who has had to accept the definition of what motherhood is, on the one hand, that's imposed by imperialism, and also the reality that she could not possibly be the mother that imperialists said that we're supposed to be because of the limitations imposed on us by imperialism. And it's the African mother who has not only taken care of her own children, but in my lifetime, I've seen take care of the children of white women, white mothers who didn't have to be mothers because there was an African mother there to do it. So she has been most slandered. But the key thing is that, in my view, is that men and women constitute, mothers and fathers constitute the essence of the African nation. It is a prerequisite, that there be a minimum amount of unity between African men and women in order for the nation to exist, in order for the species to continue. And so when we talk about African motherhood, we do this recognizing that the incredible sacrifices she has had to make, she has been the cultural, the force that's disseminated and kept the culture alive for African people. She has been our first teachers who taught us what it was to be a human being, and she has been the least protected and most vulnerable of us all. And I think that when we talk about Mother's Day, we have to come at it from a different perspective than how the Europeans have come to the question of Mother's Day, and recognize the significance of Mother Africa and the African mother who gave birth to all of us and to civilization itself. And also, I believe we have to call on everybody to exemplify her stance, her revolutionary stance. And that's why, we think of people like Assata Shakur. We think of people like Nzinga. We think of people in our own communities, women who have seen their children gunned down by police, and who have stepped forward, who have not simply accepted it, but who have stepped forward. We see mothers who have to bury their children, which is an unnatural phenomenon. Mothers shouldn't have to bury their children. It's the assumption is that a child would bury a parent, and mothers who have had to do that based on circumstances imposed on us, whether it's AIDS, whether it's malaria in Africa that we cannot deal with because of everything's being stolen from us and we can't develop the kind of infrastructure necessary to contend with it, or neocon puppet governments controlled by somebody else makes it difficult for us to deal with these situations. Well, the African mother who has defied all of this and who has called for the revolution, who has supported the revolution, who has fought and not simply accepted the definitions of imperialism, we just want to salute her and hope that the thing that we're going to be doing today here at the World House speaks to that, just at least in some small way.
Uhura, we have a caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Uhura, this is Min Cooler from Delaware. How you doing, brother?
Good, brother. How you doing?
Fine, yourself. I was just listening to Brother Yamali, and you know, a lot of times, brother, I sit back and I listen to Malcolm, I listen to Marcus Garvey, I listen to all the brothers. They have actually laid the foundation for us to follow, and it seems like, you know, I think, I don't know if it's all of our people, but it just seems the majority of our people seem that you can fight peacefully. You just can't fight peacefully, man, and expect change to come. It seems like our people are still looking for an easy way out other than just coming together as one group of people with one vision and being able to, you know, see the common goals and come together. Because, I mean, what is it going to take? I mean, we've already seen over the hundreds of years of what is going on with us, you know, what is happening to us. And it's just a shame that, you know, even like on the local level, I try to talk to brothers and sisters on the street when I be talking to them, and they seem like their mind is somewhere completely different from, first of all, they're not dealing with the fact that they're African, you know what I'm saying? They're not even accepting that as being a part of their responsibility. It's just like, okay, well, Africa is Africa. But they don't make any kind of correlation. So I want to ask Jamali, what do you think that we can do out here on the street, or people that are involved? What kind of message can we get to them? You know what I mean? Because a lot of times people are broken away from concentration, not concentrating, and they're not paying attention to what's going on around them.
Uhura, Yam Africa. The fact is that we are in a serious contest. It's a contest of ideas, and any society that you live in, the ruling class of that society will set the agenda for what ideas are going to be in the public arena and what have you. And that is why it is so necessary for revolutionaries to establish, to develop tactics and strategies for being able to go out among the people and to struggle against the ideas of our oppressor. But in the final analysis, the difference in what you are doing now and what the imperialists are doing in terms of this struggle around ideas is that the imperialists have to falsify reality. And you say they don't recognize, Africans don't necessarily identify or unite with the concept of being African, and there are a lot of other things that is generally true. But what happens is that the contradictions in the real world, like our politic, our philosophy, our ideology, for it to be effective, has to be something that speaks to the real world. It's not falsified history, it's not a falsified reality, but the real world. And sooner or later, objective reality catches up with us all. Sometimes we want to believe something is the truth, and then comes a hurricane like Katrina, and we see Africans hanging on rooftops and things like that. And if you didn't put down the place where this happened, you could think it's any place else in the African world. So what I'm telling you is, do the work and struggle to win people ideologically and politically, and as the contradictions in this system deepens, then people will know where to come to get the answers that you were providing for them before. And then people will know what organizations to come to. And I'm hoping that you are being organized. I hope that we'll see you in Washington, D.C. For the African Liberation Day, and that you bring two or three or however many people you can bring, because the starting point is to get the two or three that you can, that can accept what it is that we're talking about, and unite and create a tactics and strategies for getting to the rest of us. But it is a contradiction, but it's one that I'm convinced, and this time, right now, is not as formidable as it was just a few months ago. Uhura.
Uhura, thank you, Brother
Yamali.
I appreciate your situation here. I mean, you really bring light to the subject. And, you know, I'm glad to be a part of it. I'm still waiting for my application, fellas. But
waiting for your what?
My application for a Yuba. I put it in about 3 months ago.
What's your name, brother? What's your name?
My name My name is Minkura, M-E-N-K-U-R-A.
Okay.
And also, you, my legal name is, and my legal
name. That's all
right.
Don't, that's good. And so, you in, and where are you at?
I'm in Delaware.
Where in Delaware?
Middletown.
Say it again.
Middletown, Delaware. That's down below Wilmington.
Okay. So, Chimarangi, what's up with that? You familiar with this?
It sounds familiar. I spoke to Kobina, and I don't know if his card was one of the.
Listen, what will happen is on tomorrow, that should be in the mail. And what should happen is as soon as this show ends, can you call back here?
Mm-hmm.
Call back
yes,
here as soon as this show is over. And give the information, all that information, to the brother, to Binga, and go ahead.
Oh, what, he needs to call the other number.
Okay, what other number? Give him in.
The 727-824-5700. Call that number, brother.
727-824-5700. Call that as soon as this show is over, and by tomorrow, your card will be in the mail.
You said 824-5700?
Yeah, brother.
727-824-5700.
All right, my friend. All right. All right.
Do
hoo-hoo,
brother. Thank
uh-huh.
you.
Uh-huh.
Was there something that you had?
Nothing. All right. We've come to the end of the program for today. That's it for Africa Live here on thehooradio.com. But stay tuned, because next up is Uhuru on the Move. Right after we play our excerpt from Glenn Ford from BlackAgendaReport.com.
The U.S. corporate media treat the world like a big comic book, with America as the superhero who doesn't know his own strength but means well. Much of the time, the corporate media analysis doesn't even reach the level of comic books, more like cartoons. In fact, just a few nights ago, I saw a cartoon on the Comedy Central channel that provided a much more sophisticated analysis of so-called piracy in Somalia than anything offered by the television evening news. In an episode of South Park, the 8-year-old kid protagonists set off for Somalia, where they hope to live the carefree life of pirates. A teenage Somali boy, who's become a pirate in order to feed his desperate family, can't understand why one would want to engage in piracy if given the choice. At the end of the episode, American sharpshooters kill all the Somalis, leaving the would-be American child pirates unharmed. The American commander tells his gunmen, "Be careful not to hit the white ones." Thus, the cartoon succeeds in describing the life and death struggle of the Somalis and the arbitrary power of the Americans and others patrolling the Somali coast. The Americans here at home are totally ignorant of the true situation in Somalia, while the Americans manning warships and warplanes have no problem with killing people they don't know, people who are made to look like cartoon cutouts. It is impossible to discuss lawlessness in Somali coastal waters without confronting the U.S. and European role in destroying the rule of law in that country. The chief culprit is the United States, which encouraged Ethiopia to invade Somalia in 2006 in order to depose the first government that country had had since 1991. Since the early 60s, U.S. policy in Africa has been to sow chaos in those regions it cannot effectively control. The Somalis drove the Ethiopians out, much to the chagrin of Washington. With the increase in ship hijackings, the Americans and Europeans spin the situation as one in which they must impose order on Somalia, when in fact it is the outsiders' attempts to dominate Somalia that have led to such grave disorder. We now learn that France and Spain, among the maritime powers most guilty of illegally poaching Somalia's fisheries, have designated themselves as the guardians of the Somali coast. The French and Spanish have enjoyed a bounty of fishing off Somalia, with no Somali coast guard to keep them from taking as much as they want of the national resource. So, the biggest thieves of Somali fish choose themselves as protectors of the fisheries. France and Spain both base their fishing fleets in nearby Seychelles Islands. Any dispassionate observer would conclude that the French, the Spanish, and the rest of the freeloaders are reverting to a kind of piracy of their own, like in the good old days when whites sailed the world and